Welcome, aviators, to another Motivation Monday. My name is Chris Palmer from Angle of Attack. I am a flight instructor at my flight school in Homer, Alaska. I do these Motivation Mondays every Monday to kick off your week in a positive way. We talk about your aviation career questions, your flying questions, anything related to written tests, online ground school, technical questions, private, commercial, instrument, whatever you're working on, this is what it's all about. Lots of advice flows through these sessions every single week, and you will be able to search the different questions down below in the description and find the question that's relevant to you that you want to learn about. There's always something for everyone, so I hope you enjoy this episode of Motivation Monday. If you guys want to get notified about this, make sure to subscribe here on YouTube if that's where you're watching it or listening to it. And you can turn on that notification bell. That makes sure that you get the information every single week. If you are on a podcast, you can subscribe to the podcast as well. iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, it's everywhere. You can subscribe to that. And if you want to not do any of that, you can go to our website as well, angleofattack.com, find the blog, and it'll be on there. So let's get right into it. Lots of great questions this week, kind of rapid fire. Obviously, still a couple of coronavirus questions about its impact on the aviation industry, but about, I would say, 80% of the questions are related to something else. So, hope you're doing well. Let's dive right into it. Is it a good idea to take flight lessons during the outbreak? I don't think so, okay? And I think that my biggest advice here is that we need to make sure that we participate in the advice that our leaders and the professionals that know about these pandemics are telling us. So they're telling us that we need to stay far away from each other, at least 6 feet, 2 meters or more, and that we need to isolate more and we need to do less of the things that we've done before. So, you know, the shorter we make this, the better it's going to be. Then we can get right back into it. Otherwise, we're just going to keep dragging it out if we keep letting this spread around. So I think it's good advice based on what I've learned, and being stuck in a tiny cockpit really isn't going to help out with that a whole lot. Eventually, you know, someone's going to get sick. So I think it's best to hold off for now. Now, how do we make good of that situation? I think that there is plenty that you can do right now in your aviation career to work towards something. So obviously ground school is one of those big things. And just as like an aside, I do have online ground school, and right now I'm offering up to 2 hours of one-on-one instruction with you as you go through that, to help you out. Or maybe you're even in flight training and displaced, and we can go over some other ground stuff that you've had challenges with. Really anything that you can think of, I can help you out there. So we should be using this time right now to improve ourselves in other ways outside of the airplane. And I think it's a good example of kind of what we should be doing anyway. So there's plenty of at-home time you need to spend on your aviation journey. So that's my quick and short answer on that one. How does your ground school differ from King's and Sporties? So my take on that is King's is, you know, they are wonderful people. They pioneered the industry with what they did. I think they are fantastic teachers. And they do have a good product. It's just getting fairly outdated. And so I really try to make the design and the process of what I do really, really fun and different and modern. So that's how it separates from King's. I'm also big on the human factors, decision-making part of flying, and not only getting you to pass the written test, but preparing you for when you jump in a cockpit with your flight instructor, that your mindset is already good to go. All right. So that's how I separate from them. Sporties isn't so much like the knowledge-based stuff. They are very much in the procedure side of things. So if you're going to have videos that you're going through while you were going through flight training and you needed videos in between that, you know, teach you about stalls or short or soft field, a bunch of different things that that they teach you there on procedures and maneuvers, whereas a course like mine is essentially to pass the written test, and King Schools is along that line as well. So that's the difference there. So new trip with Josh soon. We did have a trip planned. I was going to spend Sun and Fun in Florida with him, and also go to Texas with him and spend a week there. We had some really, really fun things planned, but of course everything is on hold now. We'll definitely try to do that again in the future. And for those of you that don't know what this guy is talking about, Josh Flowers is a friend of mine. He has a great YouTube channel called Aviation 101. And he came to Alaska last year and did a fantastic trip. And we're looking to do more things together in the future. So we'll kind of see how this all plays out, and then we'll make it all worth it. Okay, we'll come back with a vengeance. What exactly should you do when you find water in your fuel tester? I've seen people just keep siphoning until the water is gone. So yes, that's essentially what you have to do, is you have to get all the different drains, you have to get the water from the fuel tanks and make sure that it is not in there, and you keep doing that until you get it out. Now, some people say that you should even be tilting the airplane to try to get the water out of some recessed spots within the fuel tanks, and also make sure that if you're looking straight at the airplane, that laterally the airplane isn't on a tilt, because that can also put the water in a different part of the tank as well. So think about that. And what this person is getting at here is they're talking about checking the fuel before you go on a flight. We do that in the pre-flight to make sure that we have both the quantity we need, how much fuel we need for the flight successfully with our reserves, all that sort of stuff, and the quality, quantity and quality. Quality, we make sure that there aren't any contaminants in the fuel. Of course, water is a contaminant. Our engine can't run on water. Otherwise, it would be a lot cheaper. So we need to make sure none of that water is in the tanks. It can get in there in fairly easy ways from just rain falling on top of the wing. And if there's a leak in the fuel caps, then it can get in that way. So got to be really careful with that. Several other ways that it can get in there, but we essentially check that during the pre-flight. Do you have any tips or tricks for unpublished holds? And I'm actually just going to give a shout out to my friend Jason Miller here. He and I are our colleagues and kind of build off of each other with a lot of the material that we do. He did a fantastic video this week on holds that you can find on his YouTube channel. His channel is The Finer Points of Flying, or if you just search The Finer Points, you'll find his channel. And he's also here on Instagram at Learn The Finer Points. But he did a great presentation on holds that I'm just going to point you to there, because he's just really good at it. What's my guess for AirVenture 2020? I don't really know at this point. You know, it all depends on how strictly we all adhere to what is going on right now, because if we don't get this over quickly and stay at home and really distance ourselves, then this is just going to get dragged out for a longer period of time, and then something like AirVenture is going to become less and less likely. But I think by the time we get to the end of April or the end of March for sure, even through April, we're going to know a lot more about where this whole COVID-19 thing is headed. And that's what we need to, look at. So I don't know. I really hope we're at the tail end of it by that point, because man, I'll just be bummed if every single air show gets canceled this year. But I trust that whoever is in charge of these events will do the smartest thing. So yeah, I don't know. Everything so far is getting canceled, and it's really bumming me out, but it is what it is. We got to be safe. Do I think CFI rental rates will go down? I don't think so. You know, I think that CFI rates, if anything, I think CFI rates should go up. That's probably because I'm a flight instructor myself. And it's unfortunate that we have an industry that supports kind of the CFI as the entry level. It'd be great if we had a lot of sage, well-paid instructors in the industry, and that is what it is. It would be nice if airplanes were cheaper. I'm not sure that'll happen though. You know, I think that if anything, competition can become less of a thing. So, you know, flight schools that aren't competing with each other, part manufacturers that aren't competing with each other, they can start to jack the prices up. It could actually get more expensive through this process. Am I too old to start a track to CFI at 50? I would say absolutely not, especially if you have some sort of background and passion in teaching. I think it is definitely something that you could look at as a fun thing to do after you're done with your other career, or maybe you're making a career switch. You know, I know plenty of people that have made the switch at that age, and they're plenty happy with their decision. So I think it's absolutely a good time to do that. Now, you know, if you're 70 pushing 80, then yeah, it's probably not. You know, you could go flying for fun, but at that point, I'm not sure what the point really is, but now's the right time, you know, to go for it. That's always the right answer. How do I know if it's a fouled spark plug or a bad magneto on the run up? So when you're doing a pre-flight check of an engine, of an aircraft engine, you're checking the magnetos, and sometimes you'll get a drop in the magneto when you check it, when you only go to one magneto. So several different things you can go there. It's either like carbon deposits on the magneto, which can be done. You can get rid of those by leaning it fairly lean, and then getting the engine a bit hotter to burn that off and see if that is effective. Otherwise it could be the fouled spark plug. So that's how I would check it very quickly to see if that worked. Pretty straightforward, just to do a quick check of that. You would run it at a higher power, at a leaner mixture, to keep it a bit hot, to get that off and see if that works, because typically that would happen because someone ran the mixture too rich. So yeah, that's kind of the remedy for that one. What's a good rule of thumb for density altitude, and do you calculate it before every flight? You know, it kind of depends, because now a lot of the airfields will have their own density altitude readout when you call up the ASOS or AWOS. I'm not sure which one of those weather stations would actually give you density altitude. I think it just kind of depends. And then they also have it on ForeFlight now for the airport, so you can get a density readout that way. You know, for me, density altitude isn't so much of a concern because I'm at sea level at my particular airport. However, I did grow up in Utah. That's where I got my private, my instrument, and a lot of my hours. And that is a case where I knew density altitude every single time before I left, because it did have a huge impact on the performance of the airplane. So for those of you that don't know what density altitude is, density altitude is the altitude at which the airplane feels it is at, rather than the altitude at which the aircraft is actually at. So in other words, it's like your performance altitude. So if it's a really hot day and you're at a higher altitude, you may be at a 6,000 foot airport, but actually your density altitude, the altitude at which the airplane feels it is at more like 10,000 feet. And so the airplane will perform as if it were at 10,000 feet. It means that lift will be less effective, your propeller is gonna be less effective. If you have a normally aspirated engine, it won't breathe as well. Basically fewer molecules of air to work with to achieve all of those purposes is what we're looking at in a very simple way. So yeah, definitely very, very important if you are dealing with hot days, high altitudes, humid, any combination of those three H's, you're gonna wanna look out. All right, me being in Alaska at sea level, I really don't deal with hot and high hardly ever. And so, in fact, sometimes we'll have negative 3,000 foot density altitudes in our town just because it's cold and we're at sea level. And that's more of a winter altitude, but still pretty interesting. Got my PPL last month in a Part 61 school. Need some help deciding whether I should go for 141 or stay. So for those of you that don't know what this question is referring to, Part 61 and Part 141 are two different parts of the law that say how you conduct flight training. Part 61 is basically any flight school can do that. It's non-regulatory in a lot of ways, and just about anyone can set it up. Whereas Part 141 is very structured, very regulated, and more supported by, I guess, even financial institutions, universities, things of that nature that are just a little more airline driven, I think is where the Part 141 schools are. So here's the thing. I think regardless of where you're going to go and what you're going to do, the best thing to look at is how you're getting along with your flight school and your instructor. If you really enjoyed your Part 61 experience and you feel like you did well, then why not stay right there? You know, it really depends more on the quality of instruction you're getting rather than anything else. So think that through before you go and try it out. But I definitely wouldn't hold you back from going to the 141 school if you felt like that was best for you. Often those 141 schools, again, have better financing and options to push you through. So that's just kind of what you're looking at, all right? Do you think it is a good idea to rent a plane right now? I'm worried about renting a plane that is contaminated. you know, honestly, guys, like I have a family and I love to fly, and a big part of me just wants to go out there and fly, right? I've said no to my friends this last week that, you know, no, I can't go flying right now. I'm going to lock down and just stay out of this for a while. That is the smart thing to do right now. We all really need to be diligent to help each other out to get through this. And I know it's weird. Like I told my family and my friends so many times that it feels like we're living in a movie and this doesn't feel real, but you need to come to that reality that we have to help each other out right now. So flying normally, I don't think so. Just wait it out, okay? If we wait it out, we'll get back to flying quicker and things will get better faster. I'm going to try to keep bringing you content so you can get through this time, but find ways to improve yourself at home during this process. Read some good books, watch some good educational videos. Maybe it's been a while since you've been inside of ground school. You could even start ground school again. I can help you out with that. Whatever it is, you know, make this a time to improve outside the airplane while helping your fellow humans stop this thing, block this thing, and help us get over this hump. Because this is something that we all have to do together. It's not just going to be partial participation. Okay, we can't avoid it. We're just going to take the questions as they come. I know a lot of you are probably getting sick of the coronavirus thing, but we got to talk about it. Thoughts on commercial pilot jobs being affected by corona? There will be a major impact. I don't know the full severity of what that is yet. I think there are several factors, okay? Three that I think of off the top of my head. How long are all of us going to be willing to participate in the social distancing and locking everything down and making sure that we try to push this out of our society? Two, how much are the airlines going to be helped out throughout this process by the government, because the government really is looking to step in and help people out? And then three, what are we looking to do to basically stop this ourselves? And how are other people that are passengers going to react when they want to go fly, and how quickly can the airline industry come back even if it is bailed out? So again, one, us participating now at home by staying away and shortening this process. Two, what the government does to help the airlines, because they're going to need help. And three, what the average everyday Joe passenger is going to do when they go and need to travel again. Is this going to hurt the travel industry? People stay closer to home now. I think there's some psychological effects there that people haven't really thought about, and that will happen to a certain extent. But my hope and prayer even is that we will get through this, we will bounce back, and that's just kind of the way it is. Now, because of that, it is going to affect the hiring. There are going to be layoffs, there are going to be airlines that close down, and I just really hope that that we can kind of stop the bleeding in several ways, especially stop this virus, and then we can move forward from there. How difficult is it to learn to fly? It's actually not very difficult at all. I think the biggest thing about flying isn't necessarily like handling the aircraft. That actually, for most people, ends up just happening through the flight training. Some people faster than others, but very few people really, really struggle with it. You know, eventually you just kind of find your way through. But the biggest things you're going to learn, the most important things you're going to learn when you become a pilot, is how to watch out for yourself. How to, you know, save yourself from yourself, meaning you are your own worst enemy. And so one of the biggest things about learning to fly is having a safety mindset, making good quality decisions. And while flying isn't inherently dangerous, I just think that most people that want to learn to fly want to do it for a long time. They want it to enrich their lives. They want to, you know, open up their world to different experiences. And they want to do that for a really long time. They don't want to just go out there and crash an airplane. So, safety first. Safety is the number one thing that you learn when you're going through flight training. You learn how to, you know, read and perform checklists. You learn how to do correct flight planning and see all the factors and make sure that you're making the good decisions there. You learn more about yourself and your hazardous attitudes, which are attitudes that all of us have from one extent to the other, and are things that can push us to an unsafe position in aviation. You know, every single aviation accident, or most of them, the vast majority of them, we're talking 9 out of 10, originate from an unsafe decision, incorrect training, pilot error of some kind. So that's the thing that fascinates me and excites me actually the most about flight training is, and flying really, is that it's actually like a whole human exercise that you learn. And it isn't hard to do. It's actually pretty fun to do. And you learn a lot about yourself and become a better person for it. What's my favorite aircraft to fly? This person asked this question just now 3 times. So I'll just tell you, it's a 172. That's what I'm flying right now. I think it's a very utility-driven airplane for flight training purposes. And I'm just having fun in my 172. You guys can see the 172 on my Instagram here. Go back, 2423 uniform. Love that airplane. Hoping to upgrade it here soon. Headsets, what's your recommendation for a new student pilot? You know, headsets have gone through kind of a period of history since I started aviation. So when I became a pilot, I got, you know, the cool thing was to get the green DC headset. That's what everyone had. That's what was cool back in the day. And it worked, it was fine. But more and more, you know, the last 10 years have been crazy technologically. I've been a pilot for 16 years now, but the last 10 years have just rapidly changed in technology. And so now we have these noise reduction headsets, and I happen to use a Bose aviation headset, and everyone knows Bose as just a very high quality sound company. If you have a Bose speaker, you're doing pretty good. So I use a Bose headset, and I find that it is worth the investment if you plan on flying for a good amount of time. If you're just dipping your toes in the water, you don't need to go buy an expensive headset. But if you're serious about flying, you're gonna be doing flight training, you're becoming a professional pilot, it's an investment worth taking early on if you can, because they're lightweight, they have noise reduction, and so you get very little of the engine noise coming in, and you can Bluetooth phone calls and music, and it just offers like a more comfortable experience for all of this flying you're going to be doing. And I kind of wish now, after all this time, that earlier on I had a headset like that, even though it wasn't an option. But I think as early as you can, as early as practical, there are a list of priorities too on what you're going to spend your money on, but I definitely recommend Bose. Are you offering a bush flying or Alaska course? So I'm assuming you're talking about in person. So yes, I offer flying for anyone from Instagram, anywhere that wants to come and do a little bit of flying in Alaska. If you happen to be visiting, just get a hold of me and we'll talk about rates and everything. And we can go do some beautiful flying through the mountains on the coastline. Probably one of the most beautiful flights you'll ever take. It's a really fantastic area in which we live, in which we operate, in Homer, Alaska. And you can find more out about that at angleofattack.com. And you'll find my email there, my phone number, and I can help you out. So yeah, definitely a cool opportunity. I do quite a bit. I do it with people from all over the world. And you know, just a few hours investment is like a lifetime amazing experience that people have. And if you're a pilot, you know, you get your, I actually can only fly with pilots, so this is a service for pilots or those wanting to learn to fly, insurance reasons. But, you know, if you're a pilot, you get to do all the flying, and I'll take pictures, and it's just a really cool process. So definitely look into that if you're visiting. Any tips for conquering apprehension of turbulence? You know, airplanes are made to handle pretty much anything in terms of turbulence, unless you're in something like a thunderstorm. There are some caveats to that. You might have some other areas where people could argue you could overstress the airplane. But basically, you need to learn about maneuvering speed. Maneuvering speed is where you're basically not going to break the airplane during situations like this. In airliners, they call this rough air penetration speed. So yeah, look into that. But in terms of how much you can handle, the airplane can handle a lot more. So don't be worried about that. The airplane can handle a ton. Even these even these smaller planes that we fly that aren't aerobatic, they can still handle a lot. Where can I find a good test question bank and or study material for the private pilot knowledge? So of course, you know, you've got to go through ground school first. I think that's first and foremost. I have an online video ground school. You can enroll in this second and start your training. Sporties has a really good free testing bank that you can use there. I know there are some other sources. ASA, Prepware, they do one as well that you can download as an app on your phone. So a bunch of different sources where you can get it. There are quite a few of them. Thoughts on doing CFI, CFII around the same time? I think it's good. You know, if you're in the mindset of teaching and taking your test based on how good a quality your teaching is, meaning your flight instructor check rides, then I think absolutely I would go your CFI first and then your II next. Some people go II next and then CFI next, but I don't know why. I just think get the CFI done first, get the hard one out of the way, and then do the CFII add-on right after that. So yeah, bang, bang, get them done. Best resources or ways to learn systems if not mechanically inclined? Asked by one of my former students. Maybe she is a forever student, Sarah. Sarah just isn't mechanically inclined. You know, that's one of the areas where she always needed some extra time, some extra help. And so her and I went through it quite a bit. And I think the biggest thing for me about systems is, yes, there are systems books you can buy. You get a lot about the systems in the PHAC. There's plenty of nerdy stuff out there, okay? Stuff you can get really deep in. But the thing for me is I just want to know the common sense of what that system is actually doing, and so that I can know the ramifications if I see some sort of development, some sort of, you know, out of place problem while I'm flying. I want to know how those things work so that I can start to troubleshoot. So while some people really nerd out on getting into the super technical details of a constant speed propeller and how it all works, which is one of the most complex things that we have in an airplane. Also one of the most amazing simple things. But so a constant speed propeller, you know, you can get really deep on that subject, very, very deep. And eventually you might get there, but you gotta just take it one step at a time, understand more about the theory or the process, the common sense on how it's working, the layman on how it's working, and then start to build the technical details from there. That's how my mind works. I think a lot of people's minds work that way. Of course, you have the people that are just super smart and can just take on a bunch of technical and engineering information. I was never really that way. I wanna know the common sense of how the system works, what it's actually doing, and then from there, I can, over time, build the technical knowledge on top of that. Because even though I know quite a bit about a constant speed propeller, for example, I know that if I dive back into the books again and again and again, I'll just learn more and more and stack on top of what I've already done. So that's my advice there. Crossland Aviation, who happens to be a corporate pilot, tips and tricks for crosswind landings. You know, I heard it recently as like a recipe. If you're coming in for crosswind landing, first off, aileron into the wind, so you're preventing the drift of the airplane, but you don't want to just land like crabbed into the wind, right? So you might be turned into the wind and tracking down the runway. But what you need to do is you also need to align the nose with the runway. So that takes rudder. So aileron into the wind and rudder to align with the runway. But it's going to change as you're going down throughout. There's going to be trees around, hills, different bits of wind, gusts or whatever, usually. So buildings blocking the wind, etc., right? It's just going to be different as you're going down. So someone mentioned it recently, like a jambalaya recipe or whatever your favorite dish is that maybe has a variety of spices and things. But you're just going to do a little bit more aileron or a little bit more rudder or a little bit more this, a little bit more that. It's like putting spices into a recipe, okay? Or whatever you're putting into it. Just a little bit more, a little bit here and there, and that's going to get you on track. And it is kind of that process, right? Because as you're going throughout the crosswind landing, you are constantly making little tiny adjustments. that gets really critical and quick when you get in the final little phase where you do put the aileron into the wind, align with the runway, and sometimes even touch down into the windward wheel first as you touch down. But that low energy state tends to weather vane, some funny things can happen, and that's where you really gotta be on the ball to get her down. Just takes experience, and works pretty dang well. So I encourage you that if you have an instructor to go out there and practice it in the real thing. I know that Crossland Aviation doesn't need it. He's pretty amazing. So that's for your guys' benefit. Home flight sim, what should I practice the most? Checklists, procedures, you can practice communications with an online tool like Pilot Edge. They have real online air traffic control that's professional, that helps you get the radio calls all right. So all of that stuff is fantastic. And you can practice some maneuvers and things. It's even better for instrument. So almost anything, really almost anything you can do in a simulator right now, especially while so many of you are out of flight training, to take advantage of this time on a simulator. I'm starting training in May, and the school I'm with has an option to start out with analog or go straight to the G1000. Which one do you think would be best? I'm gonna say analog. Just for sake of argument, I think that there are plenty of ways to do just fine by starting out on a G1000. So I'm just going to say analog out the gate just for the sake of argument. All right. The reason why is because in the very beginning hours of your flying, you're going to want to do a lot of stick and rudder flying. What I mean by that is it's not about what's on the screen. Those nice screens that are very distracting. We all get distracted by screens. You guys are tuning in live right now on Instagram, for heck's sakes. Like, we like our screens. And so when we're in an airplane with big screens, we tend to look at those and we tend to look at them too much. And the G1000 screens are big, they're pretty, they have a lot of cool information on them, and we just want to look at them. However, in your beginning hours of aviation training, you want to look outside at the biggest instrument you have, and that is the horizon, that is the sky, that is the ground, that's how it relates to your airplane, dash, window, etc. You have all of these cues on how the attitude of your airplane is just by looking outside. Now, we humans also tend to rely mostly on our sense of sight, okay? Which is true, and that's why that big outside instrument is so important regardless of what airplane you're flying for VFR, private pilot flying, okay? We rely on sight. And during the beginning hours of your training, I think it's really important to rely on other senses. You listen for what the power setting is that you're setting, okay? Because if you're doing a bunch of different things in the airplane to set it up, yes, you can look at the tachometer and get that right, or you can hear where it's about right while you perform another task, and then you verify that it's right, okay? With your eyes. You, like, the hearing is a big thing. Smell, not so much. You can hear a lot of the stuff that is happening during a stall. Of course, we have the stall warning horn, but if you were to take the stall warning horn off, you can actually hear the wing whistling and making some different noises, maybe some buffeting in the flight controls and the wings, which is cool. That's another indication of what's about to happen. So I just think that the simpler the better for private pilot, if you can choose it. If you choose a G1000 or you're forced to have a G1000, there's still plenty of opportunity to have great experiences with that airplane. It's still a 172 at the end of the day. If you have an instructor that can just put a manila folder over those things anyway, then you've already blocked them out and can use that big instrument outside. So that's kind of my sermon on analog versus G1000 to start out. But just, again, those basic skills at the very beginning of stick and rudder flying, even if you're in something simple like a 172, is really helpful. Is there any way we can order Angle of Attack shirts? Yes, go to Angle of Attack. Click on the shop icon. I have a clear shirt. It has 2423 uniform, our flight school airplane, and clear is this funny video thing we do, or I did do, but I do this funny clear every time we clear the prop before we start it, and that's kind of become infamous. So yes, plenty of them available. We don't have mediums right now, and we also have these Angle of Attack hats that you guys can get if you're interested. plenty of them in stock. What can you recommend for an IFR course beginner? I think you got to get in ground school fairly early in IFR, because IFR is mostly knowledge, and there is going to be a lot of focus and technical type of flying, very smooth, deliberate instrument-based flying once you get to that point. But starting on the ground as soon as you can is really helpful. We do have an instrument ground school at Angle of Attack, but just getting your head in the game really early, okay, really, really early, and chew on that over time and understand it and work it in a little bit with your instructor, and then go get some more cross-country time, safety pilot time, etc. But, you know, don't rush your instrument. Do your instrument until you're confident. That is my, that's my personal thing. That's how I did it. Worked out pretty well. What are some student pilot must-haves and some apps besides ForeFlight? I'll answer both of those separately. So must-haves, a headset. I think we talked about that already. I think a headset is a big one you could do. An iPad is a must-have. I'll talk about that here in a second. And battery backup, like some sort of battery that you have backed up. I would even say like gum. I know that sounds weird, but like chewing gum, because you're in an airplane with a person and it's just nice to have chewing gum. Makes everyone's breath better. I have a simple hood that you could keep. It's a foldable hood. It's called the Best Hood. A hood is for instrument type of flying. It folds up, goes in any flight bag. I really like that one. Charging cables, snacks, as crazy as that sounds. If you're really busy, snacks can help out a whole lot. Sticking to that I'm Safe checklist. So to apps after that. You know, ForeFlight was way ahead of the game. They continue to innovate. They release new features every single month. And I've been using ForeFlight since almost the beginning. I really enjoy their app. It's become a mainstay in how I organize all of my aviation material, in how I manage all that data. There's so much data for pilots to work with, how I flight plan, just everything. And they've just done a really good job. And the more you go out there and ask people, more people will tell you just to get ForeFlight, okay? iPad plus ForeFlight, that's the way to go. You may not want to get something non-Android. That's always the argument, but you know, it works great. It's fantastic. It's reliable, very reliable, which is important for a pilot. And you don't want some underdeveloped app that crashes. I don't know. I'm sure there are decent apps out there. I just don't see why you need to fix something that's not broken. And ForeFlight is not broken. It's amazing. I use it all the time. Can you talk about risk management and flying low? Yeah, I think about this a lot, because there are plenty of pilots, especially in my area of the world in Alaska, that fly low. You know, that's kind of what bush pilots do a lot of the time. But it doesn't always give you the best options. If you have an engine failure or hit a bird, you know, there's just so many things that can happen down low. And so I think maybe more because of my upbringing as a pilot, I started out the traditional way, and or rather like the airline way, in a 141 school, and learned about safety and altitude and all of these things. And I just, altitude is just one of those things that is your friend. And the more altitude you have, the more time you have. Are there necessary times to be flying low? Absolutely. Can you dip your toes in the water of getting down low and enjoying the sights every now and again? Absolutely. I do that as well. It really just depends. And you just got to think of the risk that you're taking on, and also being very aware of what you're doing down low. So don't be flying around power lines. Don't be flying super close to the ground. You got to keep to rules of keeping others safe as well. So I always say that the FAA doesn't care if you kill yourself. They only care if you kill someone else. So, you know, just don't do anything stupid. If you're going to fly low, be really careful with it, and think things through before you do that. There are plenty of people that fly low all their careers and fly fairly safely. But, you know, there are benefits to flying high too, like winds and all sorts of stuff. So anyway, and that extra safety buffer to go to somewhere. Tips on flying over the Grand Canyon for the first time. Just make sure that you know what the VFR corridors are, where they are, what the rules are, who you need to talk to, and you should be good to go. It's fairly simple. It's all there. It's mapped, and you should be able to just easily see where the corridors are and adhere to those. So it's going to be bumpy. Plan on bringing like 6 sacks just in case it's warm and it's bumpy. High density altitude also if you land at the Grand Canyon Airport. Plan on all of those things. What age do you recommend to start flight training? I think the perfect age to start flight training is about 15 years old if you're going to do it at the young end. You can start your ground school then. You can start to get your head into the aviation community. You can start flight lessons and you can build up to soloing at 16 years old. Solo at 16 years old, do the rest after that, and you can get your license at 17. I know people that have done that on their birthday, solo on their 16th birthday, get their license on their 17th birthday. I even knew a guy that got his instrument and his private on his 17th birthday. That's super cool. So 15 is a pretty perfect age. If you wanted to start a little bit sooner than that, there's nothing wrong with that, using a flight simulator and things to get your head in the game, as long as that doesn't become your only game. So that's my advice there. Say I'm flying in a non-precision approach and need to fly a flight path angle of 3 degrees. What's the best way to do this? Basically, what you're going to look at is your aircraft configurations. There is like a power setting and a speed for every airplane that's going to get you right at that 3 degree glide slope or flight path angle. So I know that when I flew a Bonanza, I'd have it, if I remember right, it was 22 squared. It's been a while, but it's 22 squared, meaning 2200 manifold and 2200 or 22 manifold, 2200 prop. And when you hit the final approach fix, you would put down the landing gear. You wouldn't have to retrim or anything else. It would just descend right on that glide path at 110 knots. So finding those configurations for your airplane is very helpful. So you're not just behind it all the time trying to figure out what to do with the power and everything. Actually, the power, the tachometer, especially for everyone, becomes one of the key instruments when you are doing approaches, because you know where to set your power, and then you should be getting a pretty good, controllable, nice, smooth glide path from there. So that's my advice on that. That's always seemed to work really well for me. And you spend a little bit of time with each new airplane, or at least learn from your instructor what those idiosyncrasies are, and work from there. 2-3 uniform plans. We'll see. It needs to be upgraded instrument-wise. I'd like to add some Garmin avionics to it. Get it ready for instruments so I can do instrument training. I am a CFII, I have a flight simulator in my office. I have all sorts of stuff, but the airplane isn't certified for it yet. So, I mean, it's kind of certified, but it doesn't have the right equipment to do the approaches. So anyway, I need some avionics upgrades, and that's kind of the next plan. Maybe some performance upgrades as well, we'll see. What's the difference between a CFI and a CFII? A CFI is still a certified or certificated flight instructor. A CFII is that certificated flight instructor, but instrument. So you're doing the instrument side. CFI can do the private pilot and commercial opposite ends, and then the CFII can do the instrument. Would like to come to the USA to complete my commercial license. Suggestions, better to stay in Europe for EASA rules. I don't think so. You can transfer over your licenses. It's very cheap here. It's much more affordable in the United States. You do have to go through the TSA and get approved to do training in the US. So if you go to the TSA website and look at their flight training section, it'll talk about the steps that you as a foreigner need to take in order to do that process. You do have to jump through some hoops. The TSA is our Transportation Security Administration, basically our airport security, but they handle security broadly across transportation and aviation. So you'll have to jump through some hoops there, but this is a very affordable place to fly. Thanks for coming along this week on Motivation Monday. It's been great to have you here. I hope that you got some of your questions answered. Make sure to subscribe to YouTube if you're here. Subscribe on the podcast if you're there. Leave a comment. Join in the process. We'd love to hear from you. If you ever need anything, message me on Instagram. I stay plenty active there. And if you need ground school, you can head to angleofattack.com and check out our ground school offering. We do a fantastic ground school. Or if you need check ride preparation, check out our Check Ride Ace course for private instrument commercial, where you can ace that test that you're really looking forward to. All right, guys, thanks for being here. We will talk next time. Until then, throttle on.